Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts. But we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and today we're bringing you an episode from The Vault. This is Ant Wars Part 2, originally aired June 14th, 2020. Let the Ant Wars continue.
Deliver thyself as a roe from the hand of the hunter, and as a bird from the hand of the fowler. Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways, and be wise, which, having no guide, overseer, or ruler, provideth her meat in the summer, and gathereth her food in the harvest.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and that was a reading from the King James translation of the Bible. It's from the book of Proverbs, chapter 6. And I was looking right before we started, I was like, oh, let me check my scholarly Oxford annotated edition of the Bible to see if it's got any insights on how the author of this passage knew that all of the worker ants in the colony were female. And no, it just says this passage appeals to the natural world.
I love that. That's some great insight there.
Yeah.
Because I had questions about this one. I was not familiar with this passage. We just kind of were looking for fun things to read at the top of our second Ant War episode. And I was like, oh, I wonder what the old King James Version had to say about ants. And here we are, a verse that at once seems to get the gender of the vast majority of an ant colony correct, and also doesn't get hung up on the idea of a central ruler. Like in a couple of ways, this is a very accurate reading of ant civilization.
You know, I didn't even think about it, but I'm sure that means this is one of those verses that's been employed by Christian apologists to suggest the inerrancy of the Bible, right? Because but I got to say, this verse is pretty dead on, right? Yeah. There is no guide, overseer, or ruler. It's just the swarm intelligence that emerges from the ants' evolved instinct. And it's true. The ants are not lazy. Like, I think that's the point of the passage. It's like, look, the ant doesn't wait around to be told what to do. It just knows what to do and does it.
Right. And of course, then there's this bit about the gathering of food and the storing of food, which, depending on which species you're looking at, is also really accurate. Of course, as we continue to look at examples of ant civilization and ant warfare, we're going to get into some examples that that are a bit more barbaric and ravaging, I guess.
Yeah, for a biblical parallels, some of these ant stories are going to be closer to the conquest of Canaan than the wisdom of Proverbs. But this is funny because it also brings up the idea of, you know, in the last episode we were talking about, obviously ancient people had been looking at ants and trying to understand their behavior long before there was a unified scientific study, you know, a field known as entomology. And the comparison to military forces and armies has been there since ancient times. But I think this is definitely not the only case where people read spiritual significance into ant behavior.
No, yeah, I was reading about this, and ants have a sacred role in a number of different religions. In some African traditions, they are considered messengers of the gods, and throughout India, you'll find various customs that involve protecting ant lines and ant hills, even leaving out food for the ant hills, or decorating them in some slight fashion, like the sprinkling of some sort of colored herb, that sort of thing, and likewise. Likewise, it's considered heinous to disturb an anthill, especially. I was reading about all this in a book titled The Sacred Animals of India by Nanditha Krishna, which is an excellent little book from Penguin Press. You can pick it up like most places. I think I picked it up at a yoga studio once while I was waiting waiting for my wife to get her shoes on. And I'm like, oh, what's this? A book about animals. I started leaving through it, and it's just animal by animal, some fascinating facts about how it ties into Hindu traditions. But then also sometimes there's a little science as well. So like there's a bit about the ant, and they also touch on some of the basic facts about ants and their role in ecology that we've been discussing here. But in this book, the author describes a couple of cool details. First of all, a tale in which Indra desires a glorious palace. So Vishnu comes to him and points out a line of ants in the dirt and tells him that each and every one of them is an Indra that rose to the highest level of existence and then fell down again via pride. So there's a recurring idea that ants, like all these other animals, are part of the cycle of rebirth. The author also mentions that Valmiki, the author of the Ramayana, emerged from an anthill, or a Valmika, after 10 years of meditation. So in this case, the author of the Hindu epic ends up taking on the name of the anthill as part of their new emerged identity.
That's interesting and counterintuitive, because it imagines the anthill as a place that would be appropriate for meditation, solitude, like quiet contemplation. Whereas when I think of an anthill, I would think of the exact opposite, something that is certainly organized from the ant's own genetic point of view. But us looking down at it, it's so chaotic and frenzied, it seems like it would be impossible to focus.
Yeah, but then I guess you could also look at it as a place of just pure order, or to really get into, I guess, a more of a topic that's important in Hindu epics, a place of pure duty. Like there's absolute duty, eusocial duty to the colony, and there's no room for ant despair or ant ambition. You're not going to be pulled in either of those directions. It's just pure absolute duty. So really, it's an ideal place to fall if you achieve some demigodic state of pride and then have to fall back down to a lower life form and then work your way back up. Ant's a good place to start.
Yeah, kind of a form of contrapasso, right? Like the idea that the divine punishment, or not necessarily punishment either, but the divine justice somehow fits the original offense that brought it on.
Yeah. So if you're joining us in this episode, you've probably figured out that we're talking about ants. And this is indeed the second in our Ant Wars series. So if you didn't listen to the last episode, we would recommend you go back and give it a listen. We discussed the empire of the ants and very broadly the endless wars that formed the boundaries of their individual kingdoms. I want to go back again to the writings of Mark W. Moffat. And this is from that Scientific American article that I previously mentioned, that's also hosted on his website at drbugs.com. He writes, Quote, in Ghana, I witnessed a seething carpet of workers of the army ant species, Doryllus nigricans, searching together across an area 100 feet wide. These African army ants, which in species such as D. nigricans that move in broad swaths are called driver ants, slice the flesh off their enemy or quarry with blade-like jaws and can make short work of victims thousands of times their size. Although vertebrate creatures can usually outrun ants, in Gabon, I once saw an antelope caught in a snare, eaten alive by a colony of driver ants.
That highlights something that I was planning on talking about in just a little bit when we get to one particular species of army ant that I was finding really fascinating. But I guess we can address it now. So, you know, the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull vision, which goes back to earlier movies and stuff, where the army ants essentially are terrestrial movie piranha. You know, you've got the Hollywood acid that strips the human to the bone in seconds. You've got the Hollywood piranha that stripped the human to the bone in seconds. I don't know if either of those are really very accurately reflective of stuff that happens in the real world. And then the ants are the next thing, the Hollywood army ants that just sterilize your skeleton. That doesn't seem to be something that happens in reality. Certainly not, I would say, with a large animal that can move. A lot of army ants are going to be absolutely apocalyptic in their implications for smaller animals, for insects, arachnids, centipedes, and even small vertebrates like little frogs and snakes and stuff. But larger animals, they don't actually represent a threat like that. Like, you can easily get away from them. The only case I would imagine where army ants might represent a real threat to larger animals would be if you are totally immobilized.
Right. So if you're caught in a snare, buried up to your neck in the sand, that sort of thing.
Right. And even then, I don't know if they would necessarily kill you, because they're looking for their main prey species, which are going to be all kinds of invertebrates.
Yeah, they're probably going after something like termites or other ants. Heads sticking out of the ground, not really on the menu, usually.
But I wouldn't want to try it. I'm not saying it's necessarily safe.
That could be the next big Hollywood magician act, though, right? David Blaine buries himself in the sand. I mean, I'd be surprised if he hasn't done it already.
Well, it's the next big confidence game, you know. So they got the walk across the hot coals thing. That's like the confidence building exercise. But the next stage is the bury yourself up to the neck and let the army ants come.
Now, another piece of house cleaning from the last episode I want to throw in here. In the last episode, I briefly mentioned pheromones as being essential to ant communication. And I don't want to gloss over this too much, because I imagine many of you have seen videos of pheromonal demonstrations. You know, the ant overlord E.O. Wilson himself does this at times, in which a pheromone is painted with like a paintbrush or a Q-tip or something across a surface, and then ants follow it. And as informative as a demonstration like this can be, don't take it to mean that there's a real blunt simplicity to it. As Wilson himself stresses, there is a pheromonal language for ants. Any given ant species uses a whole palette of pheromones and chemical signals to communicate.
Yeah, it can be very complex, though there are also very simple ways to see it in action, and like creating the pheromone trails that are, like, E.O. Wilson was involved in research that discovered one of the main glands in the ant's gaster that deposits a pheromone that creates the trail leading to food. And generally, if you deposit this pheromone, as you will see, you know, humans can extract it and put it in a bottle, like you're saying, do these demonstrations where you just put a line of it down on a table and suddenly the ants form up and follow the line. Those can be striking, direct demonstrations, even though the full web of pheromonal interactions can be much more complex. And you can also easily do this yourself, even without the extraction of that kind of pheromone, simply by, if you've ever tried dragging your finger across an ant trail, where, like, you know, if you can smudge the chemicals away and maybe disrupt it with some of the oils from your own finger, suddenly the movement of the ants becomes chaotic, gets all confused, because the deposition of chemicals that has created this trail has been broken.
I've been noticing these ant trails a lot more on my walks recently. My family and I will go out to some various nature walking bike trails in the area that are not that populated, and some of them have, you know, slabs of concrete, and there'll be these little, essentially little trenches that stretch across them where one slab meets the other. And invariably, those are the trenches through which the ants move, not over the top where they're going to potentially get smashed by bicycle tires or stepped on more easily. No, they're in the trenches, moving across from one side to the other.
It almost makes me wonder if we've unintentionally created little bridges or tunnels for the ants, the same way that on Christmas Island they have to create these crab bridges and tunnels for crabs to let migration get across the roads.
Yeah, it does seem like that, like accidental pro-ant design. Now, speaking of E.O. Wilson, I want to point out to everybody, we've talked about E.O. Wilson on the show before, and E.O. Wilson has, of course, authored a number of books, many of which are ideal for a general audience. But if you want to watch a documentary about him, there is a wonderful PBS documentary that came out several years ago titled E.O. Wilson of Ants and Men. You can probably get it wherever you stream PBS content. I know that at least here in the United States, you can get it on Prime. It's really good.
Yeah, it's so I started watching it. I haven't finished yet. I watched the first half, and it's just a delight. There's a great moment where... So E.O. Wilson, you know, one of the world authorities on ants, a revolutionary biologist for the world of eusocial insects. And he says at one point, he says, the question people want to know the answer to most often about ants is, what do I do about the ones in my kitchen? And then he says, and here's what I tell them. You get a little piece of a cookie and you put it down near the ants and then you watch what they do.
I love that answer because on one hand, it feels like maybe he's trying to teach us something like, oh, he's trying to teach me a lesson about why the ants are there to begin with. You know, I need to watch. I need to make sure my kitchen is clean. I need to make sure there's no food product, or I need to think about why they've invaded my kitchen. But on the other hand, it seems just as likely that he's saying, you're not going to do anything about these ants. You're going to enjoy them. You're going to feed them and watch how they work.
There's a beautiful stoicism and joy in the way that he observes ants, even as they are, you know, doing things that most people would regard as an offense or an irritation. You know, we talked several times now about like the scene where he's just letting all the fire ants sting his hand and he's watching it with such fascination and talking about what's going on as they're all attacking his skin at the same time. And this is basically the same attitude, but with the kitchen instead of your hand. It's like, no, don't get upset. Just take pleasure in watching nature work.
Oh, and by the way, Wilson has a new book on ants coming out this fall, I noticed, called Tales from the Ant World.
Hmm.
All right, on that note, we're going to take one quick break, but we'll be right back, and we'll return to the world of the ants and the wars that they rage.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
Click, click, put your seatbelts on. Get ready for a ride.
We're gonna have some fun.
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites.
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear.
What did we learn today?
Learning is so cool.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver. And this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
All right, we're back. One of the other sources that I was using in reading about ants for these episodes is the excellent book Animal Weapons by Douglas J. Emlen. And in it, the author has a whole bit where he's describing, basically the whole book has to deal with bioweapons and the evolution of bioweapons in organisms and then comparing them to human warfare. There's a whole bit where he's talking about the, quote, giant jaws and thick distended heads of the army ants that allow them en masse to topple so many opponents. And he shares a fun bit of experience that really underlies just how, you know, powerful the design is on these little guys, little gals rather. basically, he was out doing field experiments in Belize, and he accidentally sliced his thumb with a machete. And without anything else to stitch up the wound, this is what they did. First of all, they did have some rum on them, so they sterilized the wound with rum. But then they sutured the wound with ants. They simply placed the live ants along the line of the cut. While someone held the cut together and allowed their little jaws to snap into place. And then they tore the body away from the head. And the heads, of which they only required 5 or 6, kept their jaws latched tight. And this held the wound together and allowed them to eventually get proper medical attention for the cut.
I would say if I just heard this story in isolation, I would be inclined to doubt it. It seems so hard to believe. But I mean, obviously, I don't think Emlen's lying about this, but that's amazing.
Yeah, it's also a great illustration of a scientist, thinking about about how to solve a problem. I would never have thought, ooh, I'm cut. I really need let's get some ants attached to this wound. But it's also just a wonderful, description of just how powerful these little jaws are. Now, army and marauder ants wage their war for food and resources. They will battle other forces for control of food resources, and they'll also invade other ant societies in order to claim their larvae and their pupa as food.
Yeah, and these are some of the most striking types of ants that we see. I mean, you know, we're familiar with ant warfare that we've discussed before, say between different types of fire ants, even here in the southern United States. But seeing ants that forage on on the scale and with the tenacity of army ants or marauder ants is a different kind of thing. Yeah. This might be a good place to pause and appreciate the marvel of this one species of army ant that I've been reading into a lot. And this is the species known as Eciton burchellii. There are a lot of actually different species of ant that are commonly referred to as army ants. But Eciton burchellii is, I think, the one species that people are most often talking about with that general title. They're very charismatic, well-observed, and distributed species. They live in the humid equatorial regions of Central and South America, especially in the Amazon rainforest, but with their range extending up through Mexico and down south of Brazil into Argentina. But they're primarily in the equatorial rainforest. And these ants will form colonies of several hundred thousand adults at a time with this rapacious foraging behavior, satisfying the energy needs of the colony with raids that cover hundreds of meters. According to one estimate, I believe this was cited by Carl and Marion Rettenmeyer, who I'll mention again in a moment. They're ant experts. But the figure is that on average, each colony of Eciton burchellii kills and eats about 30,000 small animals every day.
Wow.
30,000 every single day. And so they have this carnivorous diet, this enormous carnivorous diet that is especially important because they're trying to supply the developing larvae of their colony with a high fat diet that the larvae need in order to grow. So the babies need animal fat and the adults go out raiding. So there's another really interesting thing about this species to me, which is that they do not make permanent nests. Eciton burchellii do not make permanent nests. We often think of ant colonies as defined by their nests, right? The ant hills, ants are environmental engineers, but due to the energy needs of this species, they can't be tied down to one place for too long. Imagine them trying to form a permanent nest while their larvae are growing, and they have these huge requirements for animal fat, you know, other insects to bring in and all that. Within a day or two, they probably would have cleared out all of the food sources within, I don't know, maybe a few hundred square meters of wherever they are. So instead, Eciton burchellii builds a mobile fortress known as a bivouac. This is a moving fortress that protects the queen and the developing larvae, but the fortress is made not out of structures or materials from the environment. It is made out of ants. Do you see? Do you understand? It is a war rig for ants made out of the interlocked bodies of living ants, like a cage of millions of legs, antennae, and mandibles.
Wow.
I want to quote from Peter Tyson writing for Nova in an article about these things. Quote, "This elliptical mass," talking about the bivouac, "this elliptical mass may be 3 feet across and hold up to 700,000 ants. When they need to move to a new site where they bivouac on the surface rather than build a nest, E. burchellii workers go first, ferrying food and larvae. Only after nightfall does the queen follow, escorted by a mass of soldier ants that completely surround her and will defend her with their lives." So the bivouac, again, is this moving fortress. The queen is inside and the cage cannot be breached. This was just so captivating to me. And so if you're looking for these things in the forest, the bivouac can sometimes be found inside a hollow log or just on the forest floor. But also sometimes it can be found hanging suspended from tree limbs. So imagine that, like a dangling fortress for ants made out of ants. And it falls in line with a more general tendency of some ant species, including this one, toward body-based engineering projects. These army ants are also known to, say, assist the mobility of their forces by filling in potholes along the foraging route with plugs made out of live ants. So you just smooth over the surface with ants, or also for building bridges out of themselves to allow the rest of the army to cross gaps. And apparently these bivouacs also emit an otherworldly stench, this amazing smell that allows you to locate them by smell alone within the rainforest. I would love to know what this smells like.
You know, all of this is a wonderful example, too, of the super organism aspects of ants. How with other creatures, we talk about the individual. in terms of understanding the species. But with ants, you look at behaviors like this and you see there's such cohesion. There's such eusocial perfection that you can't look at an individual ant to understand them. You have to look at what the colony itself is doing.
But there's another thing I was thinking about with this model of ant life. The fact that these ants create no permanent nests, it sort of reminds me of the idea of the strategic advantage of a fence. The old saying that the best defense is a good offense. This is actually considered true in some cases in military theory, because the reasoning goes that when you're on the attack, you have freedom, basically. As you're on the attack, you are creating options for yourself, versus when you're defending, you have constraints, you have limited options. This is often true, just for example, in chess. The chess players talk about the initiative that you gain when you're on the attack. You're constantly limiting the options for your opponent's next move if they have to defend their pieces against an attack that you just set up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is obviously true across multiple contexts. It's known as maintaining the initiative. Now, obviously, there are many advantages you can get from having a defensive structure like a nest that's buried down in the ground. The queen is very well protected, but that also limits your options, right? And this is sort of the all offense strategy of the ant world.
Well, it seems to be working well for them. I mean, it's not like they busted this strategy out on a test basis.
Right.
This has been honed over millions of years.
So there's another thing that I was thinking about, because I was thinking about warfare and Game of Thrones. And one thing I like that's acknowledged in those books is sort of like the real resource needs of moving armies. It's not like a lot of fantasy where it's just sort of like almost ethereal warriors just ranging limitlessly to do their heroic deeds. You get the idea in those books that like armies need supplies and all that. And also it's acknowledged that there are huge numbers of people that accompany armies that are not themselves warriors. These are known as camp followers, and this is absolutely something that happens in real warfare. Large armies don't operate in a vacuum. They have material needs that are not necessarily related to battle. And they also create needs and opportunities for resource capture as they move and fight. And this is why armies on campaign are historically accompanied both by camp followers that, might like sell things to soldiers, or might be family members of soldiers, or sell services to soldiers, that kind of thing. But there are also often bandits that follow around moving armies because when an army comes in and attacks somewhere, disturbs the existing order, that creates a lot of opportunities to exploit.
Yeah, I mean, it's an absolute disruption, so it makes sense that opportunists would be there to take advantage of it. And I agree. I think this is something that is well explored in the Song of Ice and Fire books, the idea of war that just ravages the countryside in so many ways. Like, it just totally destroys all the resources in the area. I think they probably brought this out well in the series too, to a certain extent,
especially early on. Yeah.
I mean, towards the end of that, those human wars, like, Westeros is just decimated and just tired and exhausted.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, it reflects reality that mm-hmm. a war is not just a clash between armies, but it's the sort of the army versus the entire environment and everyone living within it. And I think this is in some ways very true for ants as well. I was reading a really good article. It was a short article, but a good one, in Nat Geo by the always great Ed Yong, that was focused on work by Carl and Marion Rettenmeier. I mentioned them a minute ago. These are ant experts who created a nearly exhaustive catalog of all of the animals that follow the army ant species Eciton burchellii. So these are the camp followers and the bandits that accompany this army. Ed writes, quote, "There's no doubting their success as predators, but army ants also bring life wherever they march. They have an entourage of over 550 species that hang around their legions, of which 300 or so depend on the ants for their survival." So in their disruption of the environment around them, they are also creating enough opportunities for the exploitation of resources that a full like 300 or so species couldn't live without these ants, and another 200 something or so depend on them in large ways.
Wow, that's impressive. I hadn't really thought about it. We talk about the ecological importance of ants, and this is just another example of that.
Yeah. So this includes like 200 or so species of bird. One example is the oscillated ant bird. There are a number of ant birds. Ants, as they move along, the army ants will flush insects out of hiding. They'll flush out insects, arachnids, small invertebrates. And so the ant birds will watch this happen and swoop in and take advantage of the fleeing animals. They actually almost never prey on the ants themselves. And so the ant birds will fly around the forest checking in on seething bivouacs, right? They perform a bivouac check. They're like, okay, is this bivouac about to march? And if it looks like one is about to get the war rig ready and send its workers out on raids, the birds will converge here and start looking for opportunities. Apparently, the ant birds will fight amongst each other for the best spots. Of course, the best spot would basically be positioned just beyond the advancing front to catch all of the panicked prey animals as soon as they're driven out of hiding.
Interesting. You know, I wonder if anyone's ever tackled this from a sci-fi perspective. You know, we're always encountering situations in sci-fi where humanity is locked in a, you know, an epic struggle against some alien adversary, or they've been partially wiped out by an alien adversary. I wonder if anyone's ever explored the idea of the alien force comes, it decimates the planet, you end up with like a post-apocalyptic scenario, but then the primary antagonist is not the destroyer, because the destroyer's moved on.
Right.
It's the opportunist who come in their wake.
Right, the ant birds, the scavengers that come in after Earth has been...
Yeah.
That would be an interesting thing. I've never read anything like that, but I bet somebody's tried that idea.
Yeah, well, if they have, someone tell me what it is, and if it doesn't exist, somebody write it so I can read it.
You know, another interesting thing about these ant birds, Ed Yong points out, is that on top of them existing as sort of opportunists in what the ants do, there are secondary opportunists. Huh. And these are a lot of species of butterflies that follow the ant birds to feed off of their droppings after they have preyed on the insects and other animals that are fleshed out by the ants.
Hmm.
But beyond that, there are a lot of other species, and it's not just species looking for food resources. Apparently, parasitic wasps and flies that reproduce by implanting larvae in the bodies of other invertebrates, they also follow army ant swarms, watching for the ants to drive crickets, grasshoppers, cockroaches, and other critters out of hiding. And then the parasites take immediate advantage. Ed Yong cites Calodoxia flies, but also, quote, stylogaster flies, which shoot harpoon-like eggs at fleeing cockroaches, and flesh flies that lay their eggs in the open wounds of animals that have been injured but not dismembered by the ants.
Oh, wow. So in some cases, not being killed by the ant horde is worse than actually being decimated by them.
Well, I guess it depends on what you think is worse. I mean, is it worse to be injured by ants and then get maggots implanted in you, or just to be killed, just to be disassembled outright?
Yeah.
Even more amazingly, some parasites actually live within the ant bivouacs themselves, having various adaptations. We've talked about ant mimics before. There are apparently some species like this, like beetles, that survive by mimicking ants and just sort of like hanging out among the ants, trying to be undetected. But this was my favorite part. Ed Yong writes that some parasites, quote, use the ants as mobile restaurants, jumping onto workers that are carrying food and eating their booty right under or over their very jaws. So they hang out on the ant head eating the food that the ant is carrying.
Oh, wow.
Again, I think for a lot of species, this would require very special adaptations, or, you know, you would immediately become prey yourself.
Right.
But it's just amazing to imagine the tiny, like full ecosystems, basically, that are made possible by the opportunities created by the chaos of a raiding army.
Yeah, in a way, you kind of have to come back to that that analogy of the superorganism, right? That the ant colony is of what we might think of as the individual. Like the ant colony is the body. And so it is going to have its own parasites. It's going to have its own symbiotic relationships. And that's what, kind of what we're seeing here.
Absolutely. I think this is just the most astonishing species. I feel like maybe we're not even done with Esseton. We can move on in this episode, but we may have to come back to them in the future.
All right. On that note, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we will consider the marauder ants.
Hey, it's me, Blippi, and this is my best friend, Mika.
Hi, I'm Mika, and this is our brand new podcast,
Blippi and Mika's Road Trip. The Blippi-mobile will take us to amazing places.
Click, click, put your seatbelts on, get ready for a ride. We're gonna have some fun.
We'll explore and listen to the sounds of awesome places like farms, racetracks, and even construction sites.
Follow your ears, what do you hear?
And we'll meet new friends along the way.
They'll teach us awesome new things about the places and things we see and hear.
What did we learn today?
Learning is so cool.
Listen to Blippi and Mika's Road Trip Podcasts on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Who hasn't heard names like Achilles or Odysseus, Cassandra, Medusa? But how much do you know about them from the ancient world? Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the podcast bringing the ancient sources to life. Greek myth and history is timeless, and unless you've been living under a rock, you have seen just how true that is today. But there is so much more to these characters and stories than what pop culture can do justice. I'm Liv Albert, the host of Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and every week I bring you stories from the ancient world, both mythological and historical, to breathe new life into these thousands of years old stories. I'm also regularly joined by some of the most brilliant names in the field of archaeology and ancient history, authors of your favorite retellings from today, and everyone in between. Join me as I dive into the wild world of the ancient Greeks and their stories. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and I'm back for another season of my podcast, Climbing in Heels. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as fully obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. My podcast, Climbing in Heels, is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season, we're taking things up a notch. I'll be talking to some incredible women across so many industries, from models and beauty industry stars to doctors, entrepreneurs, and TV personalities. Climbing in Heels is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Every week, listeners will be able to ask me any questions. I'm answering it all. My life is absolutely crazy with so much going on, and I'm so beyond excited to bring you along for the ride. Whether we're talking red carpet looks, current trends, or products I'm obsessed with, I'm here to be your fashion fairy godmother. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
All right, we're back. So we've already talked some about ant species that are referred to as the marauder ants. You read a passage from one of those articles by Mark W. Moffat about marauder ants.
Yeah, Moffat points out that marauder ants excel in deploying troops in ways that increase efficiency and reduce the cost to a colony. And one thing that really makes them interesting is their variety in sizes among the workers.
Yeah.
They vary in size more than workers in any other ant colony. So this is where it gets interesting in a sort of war game point of view manner, because essentially we're getting into different unit types here. Mm-hmm. So if you're fielding droids, for instance, in a battle, okay. You're not just
we're doing Clone Wars here.
Yeah, we're doing Clone Wars here.
Okay,
you're not just busting out a ton of standard B1 battle droids, right? You're also busting out B2 super heavy battle droids or heavy weapon droidica. Roly-poly guys. If you're playing something like Warhammer 40,000, it's not just space marines. You're also busting out specialized assault marines or heavy terminators, that sort of thing. And so Moffat points out that the marauders deploy smaller miners, that's what we call them, or foot soldiers to the front line. And these are just weak and hopeless individuals against adversaries, but there are tons of them. So they work as a kind of barricade. They bog down the enemy long enough for larger ants to move in, the medias and the majors. So again, same species, same, a variety of this ant, but it's like it's a different cast.
Yeah, radically different body forms.
Yeah. Some of these individuals, the majors compared to the minors, they are 500 times as heavy as the smaller version. So these are real bruisers. I mean, these are monsters. My initial impulse would be to compare these like strictly to larger, bruiser heavy class fighters in fantasy armies. Like I'm thinking about some of the big specialized trolls in the armies of Mordor. But then I was thinking about it. I was like looking at the size differential here. And okay, let's assume that an orc or say a stormtrooper is roughly the average weight of a human.
Okay.
If we were to multiply that by 500, you're talking 34 tons. So in the real world, that's essentially the difference between a human and a humpback whale.
Okay, so that's crazy. Even the troll would not really capture the size difference appropriately.
Yeah, like I ended up going down a rabbit hole trying to figure out how heavy different fantasy and sci-fi army vehicles and units were. And as best I can tell, based on some fan estimates, you might draw a comparison here between a single Imperial Stormtrooper and one of those two-legged AT-ST walkers.
Okay.
That would be the difference between a Marauder minor ant and a Marauder major ant. This is what Moffat writes, quote, "The miners' sacrifices on the front lines assure a low mortality for the medias and the majors, which require far more resources for the colony to raise and maintain. Putting the easily replaced fighters at greatest risk is a time-honored battle technique." So in other words, stormtroopers are notoriously bad shots, and they are apparently easily replaced. But your AT-STs, those are far more precious.
Yeah, they cost more to make.
Yeah. Moffat also points out that the Marauders' tactics here line up with the example one sees in armies throughout history. The use of conscripted farmers and laborers alongside elite professional soldiers, with the common soldiers absorbing the worst of it while the elite units are protected and move in at strategic intervals. He also points out that marauders use what is known in military strategy as defeat in detail tactics, defeating an enemy unit by unit rather than engaging an enemy's full strength. Now, marauder ants also battle their own kind, pitting colony against colony. And in these contests, the majors and the medias also hang back and let the miners do most of the fighting, tearing each other apart in contests that tend to be even more brutal than the interspecies conflicts that also take place.
I'm going to get to some of the logic behind the differences in strategy here in just a minute, by the way.
Yeah, because Moffat refers to the work of University of Bristol's Nigel Franks, who found that the tactics of these ants in particular is consistent with Lanchester's square law, an equation developed in World War I by engineer Frederick Lanchester, who also devised Lanchester's linear law, which we'll also touch base on here.
Yeah, I keep wanting to say Lannister, so don't let me say that.
Stop I know, me if I do. Keep coming back to the fantasy warfare analogy.
So Lanchester's laws are a set of mathematical models trying to explain outcomes in battle based on various kinds of initial force disparity. Is generally the main disparities are going to be individual unit effectiveness, so like how much damage each unit can do, and then also the numbers of combatants on either side. Lanchester's square law in particular shows that in some types of combat, this is not all conflicts, but in some types of combat, for example, shooting wars involving masses of soldiers armed with rifles that can aim in any direction, in these types of combat, there are ways of organizing confrontations majorly to your advantage just based on the numbers of forces and how they're grouped. Specifically, the main takeaway is don't split your forces. So to illustrate this, you can imagine, say, you got battle droids in Star Wars, and say maybe one side has 100 battle droids and the other side has exactly 100 battle droids as well. If you imagine each of the battle droids can shoot its blaster one time every second, and each shot has a 25% chance of destroying its target, you can work out that after 1 second of battle, both forces will be reduced equally by about 25%, maybe after another second, etc. And it just goes on as the two sides decrease by attrition at roughly the same rate until both armies are mostly or fully vanquished at around the same time, unless for some reason one side gets an advantage early on. But that kind of process does not scale in a linear way. So if you have, say, 100 droids versus an opponent, say General Grievous is your opposing army, and he's just got 50 droids, you probably can assume that the larger force will win, but you might not understand how much of an advantage the larger force has. So if you have the same kind of thing working, after the first second, your 100 droids will probably have destroyed roughly half of your opponent's 50 droids, but they really will not have destroyed many of yours at all, maybe only like 12 or so. And as each second of battle goes on, you reduce their fighting effectiveness more and more until what you're left with in the end is very little casualties to the larger army and total decimation of the smaller one. And so this shows, for example, that if you have a force of 100 battle droids, it would be much easier for those 100 battle droids to win two consecutive battles against 50 battle droids than to win one single battle against a force of 100. And this is exactly why divide and conquer is such an important principle of warfare. If you break your enemy up into smaller groupings with these certain types of combat, your advantage over them does not increase linearly, it multiplies by the square. In fact, if you choose your battles wisely, you can even use this to allow a smaller force to beat a bigger one. So if you got 100 battle droids, General Grievous has 200, you could still potentially beat him overall by keeping your forces together and peeling off small segments of like 10 or 20 at a time to face sequentially with negligible losses to your own forces each time.
So this is, again, where we come back to defeat in detail.
Exactly right. So in mathematical terms, what Lanchester predicted was that in these certain types of scenarios, the strength of a group on the battlefield is the product of two things: the effectiveness of each fighting unit, not times the number of units, but times the square of the number of units. And that's why it's known as the square law. And it tells you that for certain types of combat, sheer numbers can easily overwhelm differences in the effectiveness of individual fighting units. And it's interesting how this tends to go against what seems to be people's desire to understand like dramatic violent conflict in narratives, like in, you know, epic poetry and action movies and all that, where it seems like what people, or at least what authors think people want to see, is the idea that a single highly effective combatant, you know, your John Wick or whoever, can overcome many less effective enemies ganging up on them. And for many types of combat, this is not how real fighting actually works. Numbers are significantly more important than skills. Like, better to have 500 off-brand discount battle droids than 50 elite IG units.
Yeah, it certainly does run counter. honor to our epic storytelling. Yeah, where it's like one ragtag group of talented individuals can turn the tide of battle against the faceless horde. Yeah.
Yeah, and we should note again that the square law is not supposed to apply to all types of combat. For example, in situations where combatants have to face one another in one-on-one duels, one at a time, there the advantages of superior numbers are reduced to something closer to a pure linear function, and the individual effectiveness of each unit becomes a lot more relevant. And so the way this works out in the real world is that, like, in situations where your forces do not have numerical superiority, military leaders who are conscious of these issues will try to engineer battle conditions to avoid square law scenarios and enforce linear law scenarios instead. One example would be like using natural terrain or fortifications to create choke points where the majority of the enemy forces are held back from the action. They can't all fight you at once. The number of them that can fight you at the same time is limited by topography, and thus the battle becomes, it starts to resemble something more like a series of sequential duels instead of a simultaneous war of all against all. And of course, examples of this in history are, you know, think about the way castles are constructed, narrow passageways, natural ravines, bridges, gates, a spiral staircase in a castle tower. These tend to reduce the salience of the square law advantage and help you out, especially if you've got a smaller number of more effective fighters. So to bring this back to ants, the question here is, which of these models is better at predicting the outcomes of ant wars? Is it the linear model, where there's this direct linear relationship between the size of forces and the outcome? Or is it the square model, where the larger numbers of concentrated forces just easily overwhelm other concerns like individual fighting unit effectiveness? There was a paper that was published in the 1990s in the journal Animal Behavior. This was in 1996. By Mary E. A. Whitehouse and Klaus Jaffa, called Ant Wars: Combat Strategies, Territory, and Nest Defense in the Leaf-Cutting Ant Atta levigata. And according to their research, they found, quote, the leaf-cutting ant Atta levigata responded to a simulated vertebrate threat by recruiting many soldiers, and the soldiers would be a special fighters, large workers, but responded to conspecific and interspecific ant threats by recruiting mainly small ants. So the vertebrate attack here was simulated pretty much by poking a stick in. You know, they'd poke a stick into the entrance of the colony nest and then shake it for 20 seconds. And this was meant to mimic the mechanical disturbance that would be caused by the ant's main predator, the armadillo. In these attacks, what the ants would tend to do is they would bring more of their elite fighters to defend the nest. So in this situation, it appears evolution may be favoring the linear reasoning in this case. Meanwhile, when the ants are attacked by other ants, they tended to respond instead with overwhelming numbers of less dedicated fighters. So a threat from a rival ant colony seems to have been solved by natural selection to select for behaviors motivated by the square law.
Along these lines, Moffat also points out that, quote, a fighter's value to its colony bears on the risks the ant takes. The more expendable she is, the more likely she is to end up in harm's way. As such, marauder ants, he writes, they guard their foraging trails with old and or maimed workers. And in fire ants, it's been observed that the old stay and fight while the very young run away. And in fire ants, more in their prime, will actually fake their own deaths.
Wow, will fake their own deaths. I mean, this is, again, something that makes more sense if you think about the ant colony as a single superorganism. It's like it's putting the already damaged or less effective parts of itself out in front to absorb the brunt of the violence.
Yeah. All right. So at this point, you're probably thinking, oh, my goodness, they're out of time. And you would be right. Just as the ant war is heating up, we're going to have to close out this episode. But fear not. We're going to be back with a third ant war episode that will more or less round everything out. Though a word of warning, if I'm looking at the schedule correctly, there will be another episode that will publish before the third ant war episode publishes. So just bear with us. The third third Ant War installment is on its way. In the meantime, if you would like to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, you can find us anywhere you get your podcasts. And wherever that happens to be, just make sure you rate, review, and subscribe.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta
right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars, for the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Oh, hi. I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.